Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Huge throng of listeners awaits today, and we're so glad to have you along with us. Coming to you from the beautiful blue waters and sandy beaches of Southwest Florida, all around the country and all around the world. Thanks for joining us today. Going to have a very interesting show for you. We, at the bottom of this hour, are going to have Senator Mike Gravel on. He's got a new book out called A Political Odyssey. Believe me when I tell you, this is one fascinating book. Really is. I think you'll want to read it. A couple of you buy one, pass it around, whatever, but you will enjoy reading this book. And we're going to have Mike Gravel, Eccentricities and All, on with us at 3:30 today. So do stick around for that. You'll want to hear that, I'm sure. The guy's got a great story to tell and a very, very interesting and riveting story, I promise you. 866-546-5254, if you'd like to join the program today. We're having one of those programs today where we're kind of going to leave it up to you. I didn't plan a whole lot today, so I'm hoping that you'll feel inclined to call in and let us know what's on your mind today, most certainly. I've got several odds and ends I'd like to talk about. I would like to speak about... Well, this oil situation, the drilling situation is getting out of hand. Also like to talk about the restoring the Constitution, which is something that's got to be done right now. We're in such a dreadful state right now with our Constitution being subverted so much, so often by the Bush administration. Did you ever dream that in your lifetime you would see a presidential administration just run roughshod over the Constitution and tell the American people, pretty much to their face. Screw you. I don't care what you think. And that's pretty much what has happened. One illegality after another, after another, after another. And yet no one seems to really care. I did run across some people who do care. There was an article in the New York Times by Nicholas Kristof. And there's some folks on there named Physicians for Human Rights. And I apologize for the audio of this. The audio could certainly be better. There's a big hum in the background, but that's where it came right off the network. So this is a short piece about the Physicians for Human Rights and what they happen to think about the torture that America now solidly stands behind. There isn't any question that our government, that this Bush administration planned on torturing, is fine with torturing, will do anything that they have to do to get any information that they want. And I saw one of the quotes from a note out of the Pentagon yesterday, you're only doing it wrong, or it's only too severe if the guy dies. And that's where we're at today. This is a statement from the people at the Physicians for Human Rights, a great organization.
Physicians for Human Rights has just published a remarkable landmark report. For the first time, we have indisputable medical evidence to confirm the firsthand accounts of men who, never charged of any crimes, suffered incredible torture at the hands of U.S. personnel in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay. The evidence is so compelling that Major General Antonio Taguba, who led the Army investigation after the incredible scandal at Abu Ghraib, decided to write the foreword to our report, Broken Laws, Broken Lives. He writes this: there is no longer any doubt as to whether the current administration has committed war crimes. The only question is whether those who ordered the use of torture will be held to account. As Americans, we have always stood for human rights and justice under the law. We call on the U.S. government to fully investigate and hold accountable those who ordered the use of torture, to apologize to those that have survived that torture at U.S. hands, and to make reparation, including medical and psychological treatment. If you want to join us and take action or to learn more, visit brokenlives.info.
That from the Physicians for Human Rights and Major General Antonio Taguba. Let me give you his whole statement here, General Taguba, who investigated the torture at Abu Ghraib. And I will quote him: through the experiences of these men in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay, we can see the full scope of the damage this illegal and unsound policy has inflicted, both on America's institutions and our nation's founding values, which the military, intelligence services, and our justice system are duty-bound to defend. In order for these individuals to suffer the wanton cruelty to which they were subjected, a government policy was promulgated to the field whereby the Geneva Conventions and the Uniform Code of Military Justice were disregarded. The UN Convention Against Torture was indiscriminately ignored. After years of disclosures by government investigations, media accounts, and reports from human rights organizations, there is no longer any doubt as to whether the current administration has committed war crimes. The only question that remains to be answered is whether those who ordered the use of torture will be held to account, Major General Antonio Taguba, USA retired. Do you believe any of these people will really be held to account? Do you think their names will ever come up in an actual trial? Do you think they will face a trial or a tribunal, a serious investigation of any kind, something that would hold them to account for their crimes against humanity. Their crimes against foreigners, their crimes against we, the people of the United States. I would remind everyone that Scotty McClellan now is beginning to speak out. Major General Taguba is speaking out. Richard Clark has spoken out. There have been others who have spoken out. And they're suffering the wrath of the right-wing neocons as though they're some sort of unpatriotic, treasonous seditionist. And nothing could be further from the case. Where are more people like these? We need far more people like these. And I would remind everybody, when you hear these people being chastised and excoriated by the Bush administration, to the loyalists, to the criminals involved in this, when you hear them saying the things they say about the people that have spoken out and calling them unpatriotic and so forth, do remember this. Do remember that when these people hold their hands up and take the oath of whatever office they have, they are swearing to protect, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. They are not swearing an oath to the President of the United States. There is no loyalty oath to the President of the United States. If he is a criminal, he's a criminal. And nobody owes anybody their loyalty when they're involved in criminal, illegal activity. So when they come out with their harsh comments about the Richard Clarks and the Scotty McClellans and these other people, all of whom I have bones to pick with, why didn't they do it earlier? But realizing where we are today, we have to go forward. And there's going to be a huge campaign starting tomorrow, continuing on, let's say tomorrow, picking up where they left off against Scotty McClellan, for one. And when he testifies, they will protest loud and long, and he'll get called every name in the book. Well, he owes no loyalty to Junior Bush. He owes no loyalty to Don Rumsfeld or Dick Cheney or Feith or Wolfowitz or Pearl or anybody else involved in this horrible, scandalous, illegal occupation of Iraq. He owes them nothing. He owes the people of the United States the truth and the whole truth, and I'm betting you we're going to get it from him tomorrow. And I'm also betting you there's going to be a firestorm of protests coming from the administration when he testifies tomorrow. All I can hope is that the questions will be good, they'll be probative, and that they will lead us toward a greater understanding of what actually happened. I would like to know what actually happened, how it unfolded. I would like to know who exactly started it. I would like to know if Dick Cheney is the man that twisted the arms and got everybody to do his bidding. I'm fairly sure and certain of that. But they're going to make us try and believe that these people that speak out, or these whistleblowers and all, are unpatriotic because they're not remaining loyal to George Bush. Well, again, they didn't swear an oath to protect George Bush. They swore an oath to protect, defend, and preserve the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And right now, I firmly believe that in the last 7 years or so, maybe longer, the greatest enemy we have are domestic. And if in fact we find out, and I think we already know much of the truth, but when we find out everything, and we will someday, there are things locked up in safes all across Washington, D.C., in the Pentagon, and probably in the old executive office building and in the West Wing. There are articles, there are papers, there are documents locked up that will prove what all of us have suspected, many of us have suspected all along. You and I, who were accused of being anti-American, you and I, who were accused of committing treason because we didn't believe the government of the United States when they told us that Saddam Hussein had WMDs, that he had the mobile chemical labs, that he had drones, could drop nukes on the United States. We didn't believe it. And for that, we took abuse from the right wing. And now the shoe's on the other foot. We've been proven correct. It's been proven true, what we've suspected and pretty well known all along. The Downing Street memos, many other things have come out showing us exactly who it was that started this war and why. But I want to know all the nitty-gritty. I want to know all the details of it. I want to know if Dick Cheney was behind it, and I want to know that somebody will face some kind of punishment for it. Because God knows about 4,200 Americans have faced the ultimate punishment, haven't they? They've died. They've died because of this sorry mess that we're in. Many of them died believing that they were on some sort of a great mission to protect the United States, when in fact it was a mission to subjugate a people in Iraq, take their natural resources, and farm them out to what we're now finding out is the big four oil companies who are coming back to Baghdad. Yes, the people that were kicked out of Iraq by Saddam Hussein, 35, 36 years ago, your Shell, your BP, your ExxonMobil, they were kicked out so long ago, and Saddam Hussein nationalized the oil, and those people have been licking their chops trying to get back in there since. And if you doubt for one moment that they were not instrumental in helping push the Bush agenda to invade and occupy Iraq for that huge ocean of oil that is underneath it, then you'd be badly mistaken. It's an insult to the Iraqi people. We see that the companies are going back in there with no-bid contracts. No bid. My, isn't that something? No-bid contracts. And then when the contracts do come up, this will give the folks that are going in there now, the big, huge companies, that'll give them the leg up on getting the permanent contracts and pumping millions upon millions of barrels of Iraqi oil. Let's head on over to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hi, Guy, this is Juanita.
Hello, Juanita.
You know, you think about what a lot of this could be avoided because it's still going on. If we had impeachment.
Oh, absolutely. Where, you know, we need a couple of hundred Dennis Kuciniches in there right now.
Oh, yes. But, you know, I think they should have a responsibility for what they've not done. Because they've had every chance.
They have.
I'm talking about Nancy Pelosi and all of them.
They have. They've in essence, have collaborated with the Bush administration on this. I'm not saying they necessarily wanted it to turn out this way, but I don't think they had the political will to do anything about it. I think they'd rather be in office.
They haven't listened to the people.
That's right.
The people, they have not listened to them.
That's right. That's exactly right. They have not.
And it's just think about how many of our troops, how many of those people in prisons? How many of the innocent civilians? My God, just think of it.
And we're finding out today, yesterday, that at least 108 of the prisoners have died.
Yeah,
at
I
least
saw a little bit of that.
Yeah, at least 25 of them that were killed. An ugly, ugly, ugly affair for America.
That's because they did it wrong.
Yeah.
They didn't do it the right way.
Yeah, you only did it wrong if they died.
Country can't say anything about the Nazis.
Never again. No, never again. We're
okay, Gov.
Thanks for calling. We need it. Good to hear from you.
You're welcome.
Think about that. Juanita is exactly right. What can we say anymore? What can we say when any of our people are taken prisoner and tortured? Remember when Saddam Hussein had a couple of prisoners during Gulf One and treated them very, very badly, perhaps even tortured them? Remember the outcry in this country about that? I guess it's only okay if foreigners, non-Americans, are tortured. That's okay. We don't give a damn if somebody else is tortured, but, you know, you let our people be tortured, and oh my. Oh my, that's something different, because we're better than anybody else. We're more powerful, and we're better than anybody else. Therefore, you cannot torture us, but if we do a little torturing here and there, it's because we're America, and we're right, and we're powerful, and we're better than you. I got news for you. Call this attitude what you want. We are not better. If we were, we are no longer better because of these episodes that have taken place during the administration. People are people. The Americans are great people. We've done great things. We've stood for great things. We've defended the innocent. And we've also collaborated with the guilty. So in many ways, we're no better than anybody else, especially now. Especially now that the entire world knows that that grand and glorious place in the middle of Washington, D.C., the White House, that that has been the scene, the Oval Office, has been the scene of the president of the most powerful nation on earth, ordering and allowing torture against the will of the people of the United States. Crimes against humanity ordered from that grand and glorious place. It makes me want to cry. And those who think that there are not many people on this earth who will return the favor, who are now anxious to return the favor, evil confronting evil, they're wrong. They will exact revenge from us. They will not forget it. And they will get their pound of flesh. It's wrong. It's all wrong. What we've done and what they will do and what they have done. The terrorist. But it was also wrong to invade a sovereign nation and bring about horrible conditions for the people of that nation. People that don't have enough electricity, people that don't have enough sanitary facilities, people that don't have enough schools, enough hospitals, enough roads, enough infrastructure. People that didn't ask for this. People that hated Saddam Hussein, but never did they ask the United States to come in and rescue them from this man. This administration, which either woefully inadequate or terribly criminal, one or the other. And I think the latter is probably the case. Seemingly not understanding what the consequences would be of invading that country. About the decades and centuries-old sectarian violence that would befall that country after we took out Saddam Hussein. After we disbanded their army. They had no police force, no army, nobody to hold the place together. And the centuries-old strife came out and reared its ugly head. And not only are the people of Iraq suffering, but the people of the United States are suffering. And it was wrong. Absolutely wrong. 866-546-5254. We've got Senator Mike Gravel coming up in just a few moments. I see the Iraqi, speaking of Iraq, the Iraqi debathification law is not being implemented. In January, you know, the Iraq Parliament passed a nominal rebathification law that was meant to allow thousands of former Baathists to join the Iraqi government. Conservatives and war hawks really touted the law's passage as a sign of success in Iraq, but as Reuters reported yesterday, the law is not being implemented. 5 months later, implementation of the law is bogged down by infighting between politicians. And the committee once tasked with hunting out Baathists in government has found itself in the odd position of overseeing the process of rehiring them or offering them state pensions. And the government still hasn't appointed a 7-member panel to replace the de-Baathification committee, who so enthusiastically purged the Baathists from government, which prompted the Sunnis of accusing the Shias of having a witch hunt and caused a whole lot of strife and problems in the country. Juan Cole, our Professor Juan Cole, our friend, writes that though the Reuters story is a refutation of the whole Kagan-Bush-McCain victory narrative of the surge or troop escalation, he doesn't expect it to even be mentioned on American television. Well, he's absolutely right about that. It hasn't been mentioned on American television that I can see. We're going to pause for a quick break. We're going to get our guest on the line. I know he's en route to New York right now, so we'll get him on the line, Senator Mike Gravel, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Don't go away.
Just a tactic to pull the wool over our eyes. Future isn't certain. This man behind the curtain, he hides behind his clever disguise. For peace to prevail, the truth must be unveiled. And I'll feel much better when George Bush is in jail. Poor Dick Cheney with a smirk on his face, he's laughing all the way to the bank. His Halliburton stock has gone through the roof. There's oil for Humvees and tanks. For peace to prevail, truth must be unveiled, and I'll feel much better when Dick Cheney's in jail. What have they done? The king's cronies, the idiot's son, a new world order's begun. Lord, forgive them. Know not what they've son. A new world order's begun.
they know not what they've
And we're back. Welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show. And as promised, without further ado, one of the most interesting men that you're going to ever talk to, and one of the most interesting men that I think I've had on this program in a long time. And believe me, this new book, A Political Odyssey, is one that you won't want to put down once you pick it up. Thanks for joining us so much, Senator Mike Gravel.
Thank you for having me on your program and for pushing the book.
Well, you know, I get many, 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 too many books from publishers. And I'm afraid a lot of them I don't get through the first chapter. This is one that you, if you're sleepy at night and want to go to bed, you really try and put off the sleep and read the rest of it because it's just too doggone good. It's one of those books. It's just quite simply a damn good book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'll tell that to Joe Lauria. You know, he's the one, the co-author. It was his writing style. You know, what he did is he hammered away at me for 2 years to get the stuff out, discuss it, and then travel with me, even went to Canada, visit relatives so he could find out where I come from.
Well, from what I understand, from your reputation, you're not the easiest guy in the world to hammer. And by the way, we're going to...
You're quite right. I was really difficult with him.
By the way, we're going to have Joe on in the second hour of the program today.
You'll enjoy him. He's very articulate, and I'm glad you're having him on, because a lot of times, some authors, some publishers, you know, people don't want to interview both of them. And as you know from the size of the book, I insisted that his name is of same size as my name.
It is.
And And that, I had to really insist on that, because initially, in the first draft, you almost needed a magnifying glass to see his name. And he's the one that did most of the work.
Well, you have such a story to tell. And it had to be a pleasure for Joe to help tell it. It's just a fascinating story. If I can just draw a little outline here, because we don't have the 4 hours that I would love to have to talk to you. Your family background's Canadian, right? French Canadian.
Yes, my parents were French Canadians. They migrated into the 20s when things were real tough in Canada. And came to the U.S. and got here just in time to enjoy the Depression.
Yeah. And you, as a young lad, after you got out of school, you went to Columbia, and you were in the military. You've done it all.
Yep. Did 4 years of college in three different schools, but every year worked full-time in order to get a college education, and got tired after 4 years, and decided I get out into the real world, and that's when I decided to go to Alaska. So kept on working as a cab driver to get the money to go to Alaska.
Why Alaska?
Well, the truth be told, I started in politics when I was 15 years old, and I worked in people's campaigns, and I was always interested in public policy. And so I wanted to go someplace to run for office. Now, coming out of Massachusetts, I really had no context. Parents were very modest. And then when I graduated from Columbia, I got involved in politics there and didn't see much opportunity. So I figured, well, I'll go to Alaska. That's on a periphery, and, you know, I won't be very competitive, and I'll have a better shot at getting elected to high office. Well, little did I realize that there probably was 20 other people that had exactly the same thought. And so it was competitive. And when I got there, it was a territory. I ran for the territorial legislature and lost. Ran for the state. I couldn't run for the state legislature because you had to be 3 years there. But I ran for the city council and lost, and then ran for the state legislature and got elected. And served 2 years, and then went from freshman to Speaker of the House.
Well, I've been up that Alcan Highway on a motorcycle when it was still a stone road.
Kidding. You went up on a motorcycle?
I sure did. And
wow, my hat's off to you.
That was before it was paved. It's a nice highway now, but in those days it was still
Road.
Oh, yeah.
Gravel road.
That's when they were building the Alaskan pipeline, which you helped get done. And on those days, riding up there on a motorcycle, if you saw one of those rigs coming down the road, you better get your bike off the road and hide behind a tree, because there were rocks flying everywhere. It was.
Isn't that the truth? Well, again, my hat's off to you for doing it on a motorcycle.
Yeah, my old Triumph Bonneville. You got to Alaska, and eventually you made your way to the Congress and to the Senate. And one of the most fascinating stories I think there is in American politics in the last 100 years is your relationship with Daniel Ellsberg. Would you tell our audience about how and why you got the Pentagon Papers in your possession? And as an aside, did Nixon or Mitchell ever try and come after you in any way?
Oh, God, yes. Here, it started. I started filibustering in May of 1971. It was self-evident that Lyndon Johnson was able to use American draftees to gin up the war in Vietnam. And so we recognized that, well, you couldn't turn around and stop the war then, but let's end the draft for the next president. Little did I know that it would have an effect on the Vietnam War itself, but I didn't think so at the time. So I stopped filibuster, and in mid-June, that's when all of a sudden you read the newspapers that snuck out and copied the Pentagon Papers, and they were called the Pentagon Papers. What it was a secret study as to how we got into Vietnam. and it was commissioned by McNamara, Secretary of Defense. And Ellsberg had worked with in the Defense Department, had been to Vietnam, had also worked for the RAND Corporation, smuggled the study out, and felt that the American people should see this. So he had gone early on to George McGovern, who was a very well-known senator, had gone to Bill Fulbright and others, and nobody would touch the papers. And so he was desperate. His plan was initially to get somebody in the Congress, preferably a senator, that by linking it to a senator, that would give him some cover. And that failed.
Because he could actually go to prison if he put those papers out, right?
No question about that. So what he decided to do...
I think we might be fading for a moment. I know the senator's on a cell phone.
And then they were in junction fire restraint by the administration. And then the Washington Post had to post Ben Bagdikian had a
Senator, I don't know if you can hear me or not. You're breaking up really bad on us at the moment.
Can you hear? Is it real bad?
It's okay right at the moment, I think.
Yeah, well, we're coming right into Manhattan.
Oh, okay.
Well, I can see the skyline.
All right.
And is it okay now?
Yes.
Okay, well, that's the best I can do with a cell phone. I don't... Fine. Okay. Well, so let me know if it breaks up.
All right.
I'll just slow down.
Okay.
So what happened? He was desperate since the newspaper shut down, and I was in the middle of my filibuster. Well, he had not heard of me. I was a freshman at the time, and so he contacted my office, and we got a phone call. Would you read the Pentagon Papers as part of your filibuster? And so I said yes. And so he got them through the papers to me through Bendikian, and I tried to read them on the floor of the Senate. That was thwarted through my own problems because through some machinations. And then, since as a freshman I was chairman of the Buildings and Grounds Committee, and so using the House Un-American Committee as a precedent, I called an immediate hearing that night and put the papers into the record of a hearing that we had. A Congressman Dow from New York came forward, wanted to get a federal building, and I said, well, I'd like to give you a federal building, but we don't have the money, and the reason why we don't have the money is because we're squandering in Southeast Asia, and the reason why we're in Southeast Asia, well, let me read you how I got in there. I started reading Pentagon Papers. And then put it all into the record. And that ended about, 1-2 o'clock in the morning. And that was the day that the Supreme Court ruled that you couldn't have an injunction of prior restraint, but that if you published, they were subject at risk. And so the newspapers did not publish after that. They just did what they regurgitated what they had. And I tried to get publisher in the United States to print the Pentagon Papers and touch it except Beacon Press. And so Beacon Press published it. They honored me by calling it the Senator Gravel edition of the Pentagon Papers. And lo and behold, the Nixon administration legally went after Beacon Press, Dr. Rotberg, my editor, and me. And that case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the court ruled 5-4 that I was entitled to release the papers under the speech and debate clause within the confines of the Senate, but when I went outside of the Senate to publish them in press, then I was subject to prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other four minority, they felt that I could have published anywhere as a senator. And so what the issue was, real simple, are the people entitled to know what was going on in the secrecy that was involved. And so today, any member of Congress could reveal to the American people what is going on with Iraq, all of the secrecy that's going on. They could reveal this information to the American people, and the Bush administration couldn't touch them at all. And nobody has done anything since the release of the Pentagon Papers.
And just as a humorous aside, folks, if you've wondered how one of the senators or congressmen gets ready for a filibuster and is able to stand there and talk all that time, page 28 explains physically how that happens. And believe me, that one page is worth the price of the book. I have to admit, I...
If you don't mind, I don't mind repeating it a little bit. The old days when Huey Long used the filibuster, most people don't realize how earthy democracy could be. He would just pee on the floor, pee on the floor of the Senate. Because what are you going to do if you're going to filibuster for 24 hours?
Right.
And you keep drinking. And of course, what I tried to do was to not be so crude, and so he hooked up a colostomy bag.
To you and Alan Cranston.
That's right, because I wanted to control the chamber, and of course I screwed up with the rules,
yeah.
And that's why we had to go to the committee.
Well, I love it. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned about today, I mentioned before you were on the program today that with no doubt in my mind, we could walk over to the old executive office building, maybe even into the West Wing and assuredly at the Pentagon, and we could probably come up with the same kind of information that Daniel Ellsberg handed you that day.
No question. No question at all. No question at all.
It's gotten clear out of hand. It's worse now than it was then, the secrecy. And
totally.
I never thought anybody could outdo Richard Nixon as far as secrecy, and Lyndon Johnson and everybody involved. But
and also the Clinton administration. It's the cult. It's the cult of government. Now, I hope you're getting ready for a commercial, because I'm going to be going into the Holland Tunnel shortly here.
Oh, okay.
But you're quite right. It's just tragic. It's just tragic.
You let me know when, and I'll go to a quick commercial.
And the key is, this is the cult of secrecy, and plus the entire complex is going to affect the demise of our democracy. You know, Eisenhower warned us. Well, the warning has come to pass. The military-industrial complex controls our government lock, stock, and barrel. And what's going to happen, regardless of who's president, you're not going to see much of a change, unfortunately.
I agree. The people are going to have to make their wishes known and enforce them a lot closer. Are we getting closer to the tunnel?
Yes, we are. And I'll stay on the phone with you.
All right.
When we come out, I'll start talking again so you can tell, or your producer will know that I'm out of the
phone. All right. I'll run a little tune here.
And
I'll run a little tune. We'll be right back.
Okay. Thank you.
How are we doing, Senator?
Hey, I can hear you.
Okay.
We're still in the tunnel.
All right.
Maybe the signal carries in the tunnel. I don't know.
All right.
But it's fine.
We'll give it a go.
We're right in the middle of the tunnel. Give it a go, and if I blank out, I'll just stay on the phone.
Okay.
Until I come live again.
Hey,
okay?
Modern technology, we can do whatever we want to do here right now.
Isn't that beautiful?
I wanted to, you and I have similar feelings about Iraq and possibly what's coming up in Iran soon and all. I wanted to go to this year's campaign. And I know that, and you know, that you got yourself a quick reputation this year for being angry.
Okay.
My point is, I guess, and I know you asked the point in the book, how can you, and this is a real bone of contention with me with all of the candidates. How can you see what's going on in this country right now? How can you see the way we were railroaded into Iraq? How can you see so many of these things and not be angry? And the point is, do Americans really hate it when somebody's angry, shows some righteous indignation over something that is wrong and illegal? I don't get it.
Well, let me just tell you, the problem is the structure of our system, representative government. You know, the people can't do anything about it right now. They have to wait until election day, and all they can do on election day is give their power away and for the next election day. That is totally inadequate. And so all they can, then the media, the mainstream media, just overwhelms the whole process with the fluff and the commercialism that goes forward. And so you just really, the people are trapped in a system that maintains them in civic adolescence. And so all they can do is give their power away and then look to George, look to Bill, whatever. And it's totally, totally inadequate. That's the reason why I've dedicated my life, and I was running for president for this very, very reason, to acquaint the American people with the fact that until we can empower the American people to be able to share the responsibility of making law, letting the people make the decision all that they want to make on all the issues that affect their lives, you will not see any change. And now there's only one country in the world that does this. That's Switzerland. And it works. It works fabulously well. And we have the same process within 24 states. It's not all that great because laws weren't properly designed. And, of course, Switzerland, it's a bit cumbersome. But I've spent 10 years developing legislation called the National Initiative, which would just totally empower the American people, independent of representative government, and they will be able to make laws, because the power of government is lawmaking. That's the central power of government, is lawmaking. All we can do now is give our power and election data to politicians. They then make the laws, and all we can do is obey them or go to jail and then bellyache. And so what we do, we worry about our families, worry about our jobs. And then people ask us for polls, and we watch the mainstream media manipulate us to death.
Well, they're doing a good job of it, too.
The whole commercial process is that way. Have you never felt that, I just feel frustrated today. Maybe I ought to go take a look at the mall. Maybe there's something I need to buy. Yeah, we have more stuff. That's right. It's almost therapy. It's therapy that we've been commercialized to death, and that is carried over into the control by Wall Street and the control by the military-industrial complex and corporate America of our total lives.
Well, they've done a great job of it. They really have. I wanted to ask you your opinion. I've got a very strong opinion about the debates. And I know in many cases in those debates, the ones you attended, you were more the victim than anything else, I think. You didn't get a chance to speak your mind. How did you feel generally about the debates, and are they of any value?
My wife was always scolding me when I got home because you were too angry. Well, I said, darling, if you stood there and you knew somebody was cheating on you, you knew you were being unfairly treated, you'd get two.
Sure.
And that's exactly what and they do it with a straight face. I mean, the producer before the first debate, I went in there and I said, look at, how did you select this? Oh, we selected it by lots. It just happens that I'm always on the left side, Kucinich is always on the right side, and we're like two potted plants, and the celebrity candidates, Obama and Hillary, were always in the middle. so you couldn't miss them. And then the questions, I get 4 minutes, Kucinich gets 6 minutes, Obama and Hillary get 16 minutes. And this is repeated over and over again. There were some fair debates. The debate we had with Tavis Smiley at the university in Washington, the NAACP debate was, and the Latino debate we had, and the gay debate. These were fair debates, but we do believe the Democratic sanctioned debates with the main networks were all set up. And they were, none of them were fair. None of them were picked at random, and they are all favored the celebrity candidates, which creates a conundrum. They get the visibility, they can raise more money, and then they're anointed with better selections, so they get more visibility and raise more money. And then, of course, we all know that money is the corrupting agent of the political process, and so it's fed right into the process.
We've got about 4 minutes left. I wonder if you could tell me, what do you think, what is, in your opinion, do you think needs to be done about financing of the campaigns?
Well, first off, everybody put up their hands when they asked, are you for public financing of debates? And we've all raised our hands. Everyone is a Democrat. Now you got a situation where Obama, who's raised to what, $265 million, and McCain has played his games too, that they have neutered the FEC. The FEC is totally inoperable in 08, so there's no policing of what's going on. And this is not an accident. This is a conspiracy waged by both political parties, and it was started with Obama putting a hold on the legislation so that we wouldn't find out who were the packagers of the money that he was raising. And it goes downhill from there. The answer is you won't get any solution under the present system that you have. The only way you're going to get a solution is empower the American people to make a law and let the American people make that decision. And what will that decision be? It may be public financing. It may not be. I've given up on trying to rely on the system of representative government arriving at what would be a fair process. I've been through three reform movements. They've all failed. They all favor the incumbents.
Well, it's another one of those circular things you were talking about briefly a moment ago. The more it goes this way, the less interested the public is in the whole process, and the less interested they get, the more power goes to these people raising the money, and around we go, and the American public is the loser. It's just any question.
Totally. And of course, what is the loser is the entire nation, because we are becoming irrelevant in the world. We are bankrupt today. Our educational system, one-third of our children do not graduate from high school. We don't have a health care system, and we're not going to get one after this election. Trust it. We're bankrupt. We have a $50 to $100 trillion fiscal gap.
Well, it's obviously not going to get any better anytime soon. Senator, I'd love to talk to you all day about this book. To everybody listening, Senator Mike Gravel and Joe Lauria have written a fantastic book called A Political Odyssey, The Rise of American Militarism and One Man's Fight to Stop It. Senator Gravel has got a fascinating history that I know you'll enjoy. There's a great foreword in here by Daniel Ellsberg. And I guess the question that I have most of on my mind after reading this book, and you may come to the same conclusion with a tear in your eye, where are the Mike Gravels and Daniel Ellsbergs of today? I wonder. There are a few, but not enough. And Senator Gravel, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today. Perhaps we can do it again some of these days. And we'll look forward to having Joe with us shortly after the top of the hour. Oh, we've lost our connection. Okay, I guess that's the end of that. No kidding. I guarantee you will find this book very, very interesting. Easy to read. Just a terrific read, and I there wasn't one part of it that I didn't enjoy. No fooling. So that's as good a recommendation I can give for a book. It's an easy read. It's a quick read. Lots of facts, and there are so many places in this book that you go, oh my God, I never, who would have thought? So do get it. Again, it's called A Political Odyssey. We're going to take a break right now for news at the top of the hour. You're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network, and we'll be back right after the news.
Listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The General Accounting Office said Wednesday that the bidding process that awarded a multi-multi-billion-dollar Air Force refueling tanker contract to a French company was flawed. Society of Professional Engineering Employees and Aerospace spokesman Bill Dugovich says, if this contract goes back to Boeing now, thousands of U.S. jobs will be created.
We're very pleased that the GAO recognized that the process to award this bid was flawed, and it was flawed from the beginning. We're hopeful now that the Air Force will recognize the flaws and award the contract to the rightful winner to begin with, and that's the Boeing company and the KC-767 tanker.
Organized labor is being impacted by the flooding throughout Iowa, Jesse Russell reports.
There are 14 AFL-CIO labor councils in the state of Iowa, and currently 12 of them are being impacted directly by the flooding. Ken Segar is president of the Iowa AFL-CIO out of Des Moines, and he said many areas are still under mandatory evacuation, so many residents still don't know what sort of impact the flooding has had on their homes and businesses. Organized labor has been making do with what resources they have if they can't get to offices.
Some folks are very, you know, very overwhelmed by the scope of it. I know a couple of union offices are now, you know, both working from their homes using their own computers and resources that they have at home because the offices are in mandatory evacuation zones and they can't even get in to see, you know, what they have left.
4,000 casino dealers in Atlantic City who voted a year ago to join the UAW are still without a contract. At least 75 busloads of activists from several states will rally in Atlantic City this Saturday to support the workers. Robert Beck is a dealer at Bally's.
You have dealers making $4 an hour. How are you going to survive with $4 an hour when you have to pay $4 a gallon of gas? So I think it's time now to us to get respect and get a fair contract.
Paula Cifelli works at Caesars. She says union solidarity is strong, and all the workers want is an improvement in wages and health benefits.
We just want to be able to survive. We are trying to stand for just better wages and better health care. We want to bargain seriously. That's what this rally is about.
Now here's Jesse Russell with today's economic report.
Are you as optimistic as the country's leading CEOs? A survey of 110 CEOs found that most don't believe that we are currently in a recession, and they project growth of 1.3% in the GDP for 2008. That is the lowest growth rate since 2003. Only 9% of those polled believe sales will fall, and 15% are cutting back on investment plans.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Hey, John, I just heard you got a new computer. Congratulations.
Thanks. It's the coolest thing.
What will you do with your old computer?
I don't know. I guess I'll just throw it away.
Well, my company just bought new computers, and we decided to donate the old PCs to a place that gives them to local schools. You can do something like that.
Seriously, who would want a 3-year-old computer?
Hey, it might be great for someone else. Computers can be refurbished and reused instead of ending up in the trash. By passing it on, you can help the community and the environment.
If you're replacing your company's IT equipment or you're finished using your personal computer, pass it on to a local organization that accepts computers. To learn more, log on to epa.gov/passiton. This message was brought to you by EPA, Dell, Intel, HP, NEC, Philips, and this radio station on behalf of EPA's Plug Into E-Cycling Partnership. EPA does not endorse any commercial services or products of these groups. For information on all partners, log on to epa.gov/plugin.
If you don't clean up your room, the Board of Health is going to condemn it.
The Board of Health doesn't even know about your room. What's more, they don't care.
You know, if you keep making that face, it's going to freeze that way.
Not unless you're someplace really, really cold. Actually, a lot of the warnings moms hand out are a bit exaggerated.
If you don't get your blood pressure checked, you could have high blood pressure, not even know it, and you could die from a stroke.
But she's right about that one. Fact is, high blood pressure contributes to 200,000 American deaths each year, and a third of those who have high blood pressure don't know it. If they did, it'd be simple to treat. Call the American Heart Association at 1-800-AHA-USA1 or visit AmericanHeart.org on the web to learn more. Better still, ask your doctor to check your blood pressure.
If you run with those scissors,
it's the least you can do.
Here's the guy changing the way you hear music, Billy Shears.
Tune in to Night Sounds every Saturday night, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern. You'll hear the latest in new music releases, special segments like One Hit Wonders, Under the Covers, and Night Sounds dedications with the sassy and classy Erica Richards. For requests and dedications, direct your email to nightsounds@billyshearsmusic.com. So tune in and stop by the chat room this Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Thanks for lending an ear.
Throw the second switch! Throw the third switch!
Not the third switch!
Throw it, I say! Throw it!
The Guy James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Fly! Fly, do you hear me? In my creation! Fly!
This was fun.
You're going to like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Get dropped down. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered a restricted broadcast area.
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show. Glad to have all of you along with us this afternoon. I enjoyed talking to Senator Mike Gravel. He is a very, very interesting guy. Very interesting guy, and we did have a chance to chat at the Take Back America conference this year, and I think you'll find that he is not what you think if all you saw of him was on the debate. He's very well spoken, very knowledgeable gentleman, and one of those cases where he isn't. I mean, I just put it that way. He's not what you think. If all you know of him is those debates. He's been a very influential man. He was a very influential man, and thank God that him and Daniel Ellsberg teamed up to put out the Pentagon Papers in public. Who knows over the years how long it would have been. So it was a great thing that he did. 866-546-5254. We're going to be pausing again very, very shortly for a very short, very, very short break to get our second guest on the phone. In fact, we might just do that live. You don't mind, do you? If I just dial my guest on the phone and do away with all the little niceties that we always do. Let's just do that one. See what happens. Okay. Take one of the earphones off here. All right. There we go. We got the dial tone. Da, da, da. This is the first time I've tried this. Getting somebody live, calling live like this. Hi, Joe. Hey, this is Guy James at the Guy James Show. I'll be right back with you, okay? Just one second. See, that wasn't so bad. That's how we do it. Now, let's go live. Ladies and gentlemen, as previously mentioned, we have Joe Loria, who helped write A Political Odyssey, along with Senator Mike Gravel, whom we had on just a few minutes ago. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
How did you get hooked up with Senator Gravel?
Well, a friend who I'm actually sitting here with right now told me that Mike was going to be running for president. That was back in March 2006, and we met at the Waldorf Astoria in New York for breakfast. I'd never met him before, and that breakfast turned into lunch 4 hours later. And I realized that I'd met an American politician with whom I agreed on almost every position, which I never thought would happen. So I thought I wanted to tell his story. I knew Mike was a complete long shot. But his story is interesting, and sometimes losers, in quotes, are more interesting than the people who win when we're in a rigged game, as we are in the political system, in terms of money. So I followed Mike around the country on my own dime to Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada. I went to Carson City to do an article that I did eventually for the Progressive magazine. And in a parking lot in Des Moines, Mike said, we should do a book. And I thought about it, but, you know, Mike wasn't a big name at that time. He had been forgotten. He had been a name, of course, in the 70s. So I put a book proposal together, and I launched it only when Mike appeared in that first debate in South Carolina in April of 2007, when we made a big splash. I did an article about him in the Boston Globe then, and I got a contract to write the book, and we worked on it together. So that's how I went with Mike to Quebec to visit his family there, and we went to Massachusetts, his hometown. I went to Alaska for a week to research it. He turned over his papers, newspaper archives, interviews, and put together a story that is really two stories, Mike's career and the history of American militarism, or the military industry and the military establishment, relationship between government and the industry going back from the earliest time in the Republic of George Washington until today. And those two stories intersect in the 70s when Mike went into the Senate. And that was a particularly interesting time because after the Second World War, unlike other wars when the military industries and the military demobilized, the soldiers were sent home, companies that made rifles for the Second World War, cannons suddenly made bicycles and sewing machines. But after the Second World War, Truman changed all that. The industry that grew up that made America the most powerful and rich nation on a devastated earth after World War II, I think could not give up the profits that they had made. And a false fears of a new threat, which was an exaggerated threat of the Soviet Union, which was a minor threat, I think, at the beginning particularly, was elevated to a world historical threat that justified a continued war economy, a peacetime draft by Truman. And we see that thing just change right into the war on terror now. some of the same players and actors that were involved in the 60s and 70s when Mike was in the Senate, like Wolfowitz and Pearl, as aides to Scoop Jackson, you know, became, of course, the big guys in the Bush administration.
Cheney.
And Rumsfeld, of course.
Right.
You know, who was directly involved in trumping up fears about the Soviets. You know, false ideas of how many missiles they had, submarines. It was all lies. And we're hearing that kind of lies about the threats on terrorism. These are real threats, but they're exaggerated, I think, for the purpose of aggrandizing power and wealth of people who are involved in the military industries, the Pentagon. And Congress, of course, is bought and paid for, and the press. So we don't hear this story. The people are distracted by the press. And while that's happening, they believe the lie that are transmitted through that corporate press that we're in mortal danger and we have to spend all this money, not on health care, not on transportation, not on education, but on missiles, bombs, new nuclear weapons, ABM treaties. You know, Mike's got to the Senate in the 70s, which was a rare period, I think, in American history.
Very.
Where we had the militarists who had ruled since the end of the Second World War were in retreat. That's one of the chapter titles, because they lost a war in Vietnam. So, and there was detente under Nixon. So for 7 years, we had the House Committee on Assassinations, we had the Church Committee and the Senate. They actually looked into the innards of what the CIA and what this national security state that Truman created in 47 had actually done over the last 20 years. And enormously revealing things came out about the dirty tricks of the assassinations, the assassination attempts, and the coups in Guatemala, Iran, and elsewhere. And that was shut closed in 1980, the year that Mike was kicked out of the Senate, when the Republicans took back the Congress and Ronald Reagan came to power and the militarists were restored. We had 7 years to examine ourselves as a nation. What had we become with all this power and wealth that we had? And we became an ugly, frightening power and not the liberators that we were during World War II. And they still trade off of that. You hear the Bush even talking about appeasers. All the language of World War II is still used. Every enemy we're going to fight, Saddam, Noriega, is Hitler, suddenly. Well, that's over. America was a liberating army in the Second World War. I don't think anybody could doubt that, but no longer we are. And people around the world are learning that now. After all the intervention in Central America, now in the Middle East, I think that's become clear.
Well, it has, and it makes you wonder. The media, for example, have they been that convincing, or is the American public that gullible? You know, they've just let us.
They're distracted. I don't think the American people are gullible as much as distracted by economic concerns. People aren't doing that well. They're under a lot of pressure. They're also distracted by advertising and make consumerism sort of the. You know, almost the religion of the age in terms of how we're constantly told to buy, what great consumers we are, and making a living. I think it's up to the press, that's their full-time job, and I'm a member of the press, to inform the public, because they have other things to do. They need to be informed to be able to decide how to vote and what their congressmen are doing, and the press is doing a miserable job. It's got worse and worse as the consolidation of the media has gone on, but it protects this corporate structure that is led by war, unfortunately, and that's where many of its profits come from. And
well,
its resources, and it's a disaster situation. It needs to change, obviously.
Well, yeah, time will tell if it does. I was going to say I can easily understand how you could turn a breakfast into a lunch and probably even a dinner and a late night coffee with Senator Gravel. Fascinating guy. Who's had a most interesting life, and I think for the youngsters, the young demographic listening, that probably before this presidential race had not even heard of Senator Gravel. I don't think a lot of them are aware of just how important he was in our American history with the Pentagon Papers, Ian Ellsberg. That was a great watershed moment in this country, I believe.
The book begins with Mike reading the papers and the court battle he had in the Supreme Court to get that published. And then we give a history of the military industry and Mike's life growing up during the Depression. And then, you know, in the 70s, as I said, he got in that special period and he fought Scoop Jackson, is really sort of the symbol of military-industrial relationship in the Congress. And Mike was a protagonist fighting against this antagonist, Scoop Jackson, and they fought in it. Over the ABM that Nixon wanted to build, and we have a great scene where Mike is brought by Scoop to see Nixon in the Oval Office, and Mike was only in the Senate a few months, and he was very impressed to be alone with just Jackson and Nixon. And Nixon, as you read, Nixon says absolutely nothing about the ABM. He had just been reading, Mike, a Time magazine article about the ABM system that Nixon wanted. He learned more about it from a news article than this top-secret briefing he got from Nixon. So Mike did a great thing with the Pentagon Papers, and he was in a period when he could do that, and he did do it, and a lot of other senators did. And we're hoping now that a defeat in Iraq, or at least the people are starting to turn against this militarism. But it's a long road ahead, and as Mike points out, he probably told you about National Initiative, and but sure. Mass movements as well. Mass movements, I don't think that changes, of course, because the Congress won't do anything, won't be pressured except by the people and the executive as well, which has become way too powerful, as we see. And there's a story, you know, there are anecdotes in there about Jackson, about Frank Sinatra, Jane Fonda. You know, Mike was hanging out in Hollywood as much as he was in Washington in those days, so he was a good-looking guy, and so there's a little bit of that in the book as well. I think it's entertaining.
Yeah, he got bit by the Hollywood bug a little bit there.
He did.
One of my listeners wants me to ask you if the attitude actually developed with that what we did in World War II influenced the subsequent perspectives of my country, right or wrong, or something similar to that, because of our great victory and because of all the the nationalism that we had going and the fervor for the war and all that. Do you think that's what made us into that my country, right or wrong type thing?
I do. I think that always existed to some extent, but I think the Cold War, in many ways manufactured by Truman and Acheson and Nitze and these people, was the turning point. Because, as you know, before the war began, there were most Americans did not want to get into that war. The foreign war, they weren't interested in that before the First World War. So they didn't want to be the world policeman and take on that kind of profile. But now that happened, and with the phony threats of the Soviets, I think it became such a black and white simplified issue that it became America's always right, better dead than red, that kind of attitude. And we're still living with that consequence of that militarism and that propaganda, where patriotism is real patriotism, love of your country, being critical of what your leaders do, really looking out for the interests of all Americans, has been replaced by a phony patriotism, which is looking out for the interests of a small number of people who profit from these wars, basically. The rest of us sort of have to tag along. It's really distressing.
And you
mean, they could only change if people stand up. The people are the enemy of the militarists. They don't want people to know what they're doing. It's supposed to be a great bringing of democracy to Iraq, and you know that that's not true.
Well, one more time, it's another case of follow the money, isn't it? So sad. So sad that it's follow the money in this whole thing. You can just, you could smell it from day one.
All the oil. Today, the New York Times reports that four oil companies are getting a no-bid contract from the Iraqi government. Of course, it wasn't about the oil, was it?
No.
It was about democracy. Pretty sad.
Our benevolent politicians, our benevolent Bush administration and others as well, we just want to help these poor folks out and get them some good old-fashioned American democracy. Yeah.
We don't even have it. It's been our own democracy in such danger. Who are they to export it? That's true.
Yeah, especially like when we have a president of the United States last week commenting on a 5-4 decision by the Supreme Court on habeas corpus, saying that, I had two lower courts and an appellate court with me, so I had more courts with me. I read that and thought, oh my God, if that isn't one of the dumbest things I ever heard in my life. So in other words, I think I mentioned yesterday, in other words, a case could come up through the court system and through five or six lower courts and finally get to the Supreme Court and lose. And so you could claim victory by having your victories all in the lower court. I mean,
how did he get away with that, guys? People are not educated about how the court system works. The education system is failed because there's no money that going to it. The press is not going. How do you think you can get away with that kind of stuff?
Well, with 50% of our entire budget going toward the military every year, it's no wonder that every other aspect of American life
fight
is suffering.
As Mike asked, fight whom? Who are our enemies?
Yeah.
What threats we?
Exactly.
Who can be afraid of the United States? Who could we possibly be afraid of?
It would be interesting, wouldn't it, if we could somehow magically identify who our real enemies are. I have the feeling it would be a ragtag small group of people scattered around the world. To be sure, we have some enemies, but nothing like this huge, monstrous force that the administration would have us believe is surrounding us right now. It's greatly exaggerated.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Well, Joe, I want to thank you so much for being on the program. I greatly appreciate it. This is a fabulous book, and my audience is going to get tired of me saying that today, but it's so rare that I get a book that I just can't put down. I get so many books from publishers, and this is one is as soon as you get through the foreword, you're going, oh, yeah, I'm into something good here, and you've done a great job with it. It's very easily read, and absolutely fascinating. You've done a great job of putting this together.
Thank you so much, Guy. That's really kind.
Ladies and gentlemen, Joe Loria, along with Senator Mike Gravel, authors of The Political Odyssey. Joe, thanks again for being on the program.
Thank you, Guy. All the best.
Well, I've said what I can say. It is a great book, and again, the title, Political Odyssey. As you can tell, I'm one of those people, when I get into something I really like, I probably talk too much about it, but this is the best damn book I've read in quite a while, and I'm shocked by that. I really am. Until I met Mike Gravel in D.C. the last time I was there, you know, I was kind of like a lot of you. I'd only seen him on TV, and I read about him, of course. I knew all about the Pentagon Papers and Daniel Ellsberg, but if you're not well-versed on that, do Google that and look it up. Daniel Ellsberg and Senator Gravel performed a heroic service, great service, to the people of the United States, and it's just too damn bad that we didn't learn a better lesson from it, or a longer-lasting lesson. How quickly we forget in this country. One would think that after what we went through at Vietnam, and did this soul-searching, this self-examination, and had the whole thing laid bare by Senator Gravel and Daniel Ellsberg, for all the world to see what went wrong, how it went wrong, where it went wrong, and who did it, one would think we would have learned a damn good lesson right now to never, ever let that happen again. And here we are. Here we are. We've done it again. And you know what? I've got a feeling we're going to do it another time, sometime before the election. I've got the worst feeling about that. I do hope that all the emphasis that we the people and some of the media have put on them about, hey, we know what you're up to in Iran. We recognize the rhetoric that's coming out of Washington right now as a pre-war rhetoric that we've heard before. I hope that will somehow exert enough pressure on this administration to keep them from making what could well be the most horrible mistake that this country's ever, ever been involved in. We must, at all cost, keep them from doing that. And there's so many people that I read, oh, they wouldn't do that. They wouldn't do that. Invading Iraq was one thing, but they wouldn't be dumb enough to invade Iran. And then, of course, you got the other group, yeah, by God, let's light them nukes up and let them have it. Let them have it, boy. Yes, sir. That Ahmadinejad, whatever his name is, we'll kick his ass. We'll glass the place. You've all heard that. You've heard it. We're America, by God. We're tough. And we're right, no matter what. I don't care if we are wrong. We're right. And so if any of them foreigners say anything about us, we're going to let them have it. I've heard that so many times. And I'm sorry about the accent. I got a lot of crackers around here that talk that way. But it's a scary thought. It is a scary thought, knowing so many people think that way and knowing that so many people are so malleable. And of course, Stone mentions on the chat room, it may be a long time between now and November and January 20th, 2009. Could be a long time. There could be a lot of things happen in this country, and some of them not very good. Not very good at all. 866-546-5254. Love to have you join us on the program today. 866-546-5254. We're going to be back in just a couple of minutes.
I think that the members of the Judiciary Committee should read the resolution, and we'll be providing supporting documentation. It only takes one of the 35 articles to establish an impeachable offense. But I think the scope of President Bush's conduct is such that I offered 35 different articles, any one of which I think would be substantive enough to warrant impeachment. The minute that leadership said, this is dead on arrival, I said that I hope that they believe in life after death, because this thing's coming back. I'll go back to the floor with it.
In 30 days
from the day that it was referred to committee, somewhere in there, 31 days.
Okay.
The first chance I get, I will be coming back with more. The thought is that just by sending it to committee, some would think that, well, it's going to die. Well, it's not going to die, because I'll come back with more articles, not 35, but perhaps 60 articles. Our Democratic leaders, who are friends of mine, who I support in their leadership. I voted for the for Nancy Pelosi when we closed ranks after John Murtha stepped out. I voted for Mr. Hoyer. I supported him in the past. On this question, I strongly disagree with their reading of the Constitution and with their understanding of what the mission and role of Congress ought to be at this place and time. This election will come and go. But our democracy must not come and go.
welcome back to the Guy James Show. Money, 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 that's what makes the world go around, isn't it? Ah, so true. Every time we talk about politics, we're talking about money, aren't we? Yes, right. Eventually, everything that gets done in Washington, D.C. is about money. Money, money, money. Mostly raising money, right? For the politicians. Hey, let's head on over to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hey, Guy, it's Sandra.
Hi, Sandra.
Hey, listen, I just called in to, you know, I don't know if you heard, but the same Democratic Party that gave us Alito and Roberts have now, you know, assaulted the Fourth Amendment pretty badly with this FISA compromise capitulation thing they just, you know, agreed to. And it's really outrageous because it, not only does it give complete immunity to these telecoms, but it also opens up us to be spied on without warrants pretty easily now. It's like going back to the days of J. Edgar Hoover before the original FISA.
Well, I'm not surprised.
It's just, you know, and another no-strings attached funding bill, it's all going to be tied, bundled together, you know, and it's just sort of courtesy of the Democratic-controlled Congress. And I'm just sort of, you know, thinking, what is this, you know?
It's so hard to understand. I mean, I understand the money. I know that, you know, everybody's got the huge contributions and march to the beat of the military-industrial complex in many cases. But knowing how so many of us feel about this war, they must have all taken stock of exactly where they think they are in the polls with their constituency, and they were able to go ahead and make their votes the way they did, not giving a damn what we thought, obviously, because they know we're not for it. They know that. Our Democratic people know that, and it's so disappointing that they go ahead and do it anyway. Thank God at least our presidential candidate spoke out against it.
I wish he would pop up about this FISA, because I realize this is a kind of arcane, you know, it's not something that your everyday people are going to be looking at who has time, but a lot of us are, because I'm quite disturbed by the idea of, you know, the government being able to spy on us at will. It just is a slippery slope. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, Sandra, as they all like to say, hey, if you don't have anything to worry about, you know, if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to worry about.
Well, yeah, but that's just, you know, that's...
Isn't that a crutch?
It's a load, and it represents really extreme ignorance of what totalitarianism is. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I don't mean to go, you know, that way, but I'm sick of hearing the ignorance about it, because once they open that door, your privacy is really important. I understand the Fourth Amendment was written before we had this technology, but the same premise is the same. My personal papers are mine, and unless you have a court order, expected to have a modicum of privacy. I understand that.
You're right,
you know, it's a bit naive, but it's just disgusting that... You know what I'm saying?
You're right. The privacy is just as important now as it was in 1789. I mean,
yeah.
It's absolutely just as important. Technology or not, privacy is privacy.
No, I mean, it's a hallmark of, you know, this so-called democracy. So what I see happening is, you know, as the Bill of Rights go, so goes this experiment, because it leaves nothing but just some sort of corporate wasteland to me. There's no, you know, there's nothing very joyous about America if you don't have constitutional protections, because then you're just open to being preyed upon by these corporations. You know what I mean?
Sure, and it's disgusting on the one hand to hear him say, well, we're helping plant democracy and freedom in the Middle East, and back home in the domestic scene, we're taking it away. It's bizarre.
And, you know, it's like, I understand there's a lot on Obama's shoulders, but he's the one running, so... you know, he needs to clarify, because he's a constitutional scholar, he needs to clarify what he thinks and what he plans on doing to restore just the basic rights. I'm just sort of really so sickened by, you know, how apathetical people are about what's transpiring up here, because we elected Democrats in 2006, you know, to try to do something, not to join hands. I mean, are they trying to cover their own asses, too?
Sure.
Have they been torturing, too? I mean, I'm starting to wonder, because it's all really Smells bad. Smells real bad.
It does. It does indeed.
Anyway, I didn't mean to. That's my little rant. I'm just sort of just disturbed.
Well, you're welcome to your rant any time on the show.
Oh, no.
I've been known to do it myself now and then.
Oh, God. Well, no, I always look forward to it. But, I mean, you know, of course I'm trying to keep up something positive. I mean, I have to say I'm real pleased with old Jim Webb. He's kind of surprisingly refreshing, that guy.
He is.
Keeping up with him?
Yeah. Oh, yes. And, you know, I had a chance to meet the man and have a long conversation with him in the Capitol building one day, and
right.
He is, I really like the guy. Two guys that I ran into the last time I was there that I thought, man, him and Jim Tester from Montana, those two are really something in different ways.
Jim Tester, he's the one that lost a finger actually working, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, and I said something to him. He said something about shaking hands and his finger, and I said, I'm a farmer too. I understand, because lots of farmers got fingers missing. I don't, but so we always know what happened usually. But anyway, he's a.
Well, no, the first time I noticed Jim Webb was like a few days after he was sworn in. He wrote this op-ed about workers. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Straight to the point. Really sort of class aware. You know, you could have knocked me over. I was really surprised. And so I've been following him ever since. And I don't know. I think Obama should pick him.
It wouldn't hurt my feelings one bit. I like the guy quite a lot. He's smart. He's really smart. And the other thing, you ask Jim Webb a question, you're going to get the answer. Whatever's on his mind, he's going to tell you. And I love that.
But that's why I always laugh when every time I hear that he's going to be on those horrible Sunday shows. I try to tune in because he has this way of just shutting them down quickly and just telling them straight what's going on. It's just wonderful to behold because, you know, you never get that on those Sunday shows.
I'd like to get that Meet the Press job. I think I'll go and apply for it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't last only about 2 weeks because after sitting there asking, let's say, Dick Cheney a question...
Oh.
Nine times and not getting the answer, I'd ask a tenth.
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, God knows what they're going to replace that Russet with. Just probably more of the same, right?
Oh, yeah. It'll be interesting to see who does get that job. I'm so glad all of that's over with as of yesterday. Like I said yesterday, I didn't have anything against Tim Russert. I didn't know him personally, but man, they got carried away with that deal, didn't they?
Mm. Oh, no, listen, I don't, you know, I'm still, you know, jaw-dropping, sort of gobsmacked by that pseudo state funeral that they had.
Yeah,
Are
it was.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, it was. That was something else.
And they try to just position that with his working class roots. I mean, I want to be sick. I want to barf. You know
I know.
What I'm saying?
I know.
It's like it is so. They must really think we're real dumb. Okay.
Well, they do. They do. There's no doubt. They know. They know what they're dealing with.
But I don't really think it bodes that great for them to behave in this manner because I think that the public. Have to be on to how totally sycophant they are, you know?
You would think by now. You never know.
I suppose when you're trying to eat and work all the time, you know, you don't really have time.
I guess that's it.
All that.
That's probably it. I hope that's it.
Yeah, anyway, I'll let you go. Have a
good one. Thanks, Sandra. Good to hear from you.
Bye-bye.
Ah, yes, 866-546-5254. We need some leadership. I hope Barack Obama will provide that leadership, the leadership that we need. And you know, the thing about leadership is that inherently you have to be a leader. And unfortunately, for quite a few years now, people... The so-called leaders that we have, they're not leaders, they're poll readers. And they're poll hacks, and they think there's some sort of a magic formula of stances somehow that'll, you know, get them in office and keep them in office. But we need leaders, to get people that'll come to you from the heart. Somebody that's got a deeply ingrained belief in something and is willing to stand and fight for it, whether it's politically popular or not. And I'm hoping Barack Obama is that man. I hope he can do that. I hope I'm hoping he can stay away from the political side of it so much, constantly running for office and instead of being a leader. That's what we need right now. We need one of those very rare people to come up and take a real leadership role. I think maybe he's the guy. Let's head on over to the phones. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hey, Guy, it's Kevin from Brooklyn.
Hi, Kevin.
Yeah, I just want to say, you know, I kind of agree with you and what I believe Sandra said, or Wanda.
Sandra,
about what was said about Tim Russell. But, you know, one thing you got to take into consideration, look who was signing off on his paycheck.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's exactly right.
And I think, you know, I don't know him personally, but from what I saw, he was a pretty decent guy.
Yeah.
Considering, you know, because me personally, to me, he's like, unfortunately, good who die young. Look, Bill O'Reilly is still alive.
Yeah. Oh, yes. That old story that God always takes the good ones, that can't be true. Because
you know, Tim Russell, to me, was a decent human being considering who signed off on his paycheck.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. I couldn't agree more. You get the old GE there. Those boys are as guilty in this whole thing as anybody, as far as complicity in the war and this administration and how it's acted and gotten away with it and all. You remember when the war started. You remember all the great music they came up with and the visuals and everything and the special effects. And, man, you could tell we were going to be at war, and they were loving it, as was Fox.
Yeah, but Fox kind of loved it a bit more.
Yeah, they really took it to heart. When we had Senator Gravel on earlier today, I don't know if I mentioned or not, but that's where he was headed. He was headed to the Fox studio, and I don't know whether he's going to be on Fox News or Fox Business News, one or the other coming up here shortly. But anyway, he told me he was down in Philadelphia, and they sent a car for him from Manhattan. And I said, well, you know, buddy, you're not getting any car from the Guy James Show. We're not going to send our car for you. But I laughed and had a good time. But yeah. You'll see Gravelli on either Fox Business News or Fox News tonight. I forget which one.
Yeah.
I'm not watching Fox.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, like I said, you know, look at the people who are Ann Coulter.
Oh, yeah.
And well.
Laura Ingraham's got a show on there now, from what I understand. Does anybody know, and I've tried hard to find out, and I've got some pretty good connections. I've tried very hard to find out what's happening with Laura Ingraham right now. You know, her radio show is, I don't know if you want to call it, it's still on. But they've had guest hosts for I don't know how many weeks in a row now. There's a big mystery around what has happened to Laura Ingraham's radio show, and she's showing up on TV on Fox, and she's saying, I'm going to be back, but nobody's got the answer. Even locally here, they have taken her show off and replaced it with, Glenn Beck.
Well, you know, people recycle themselves like bad fungus through right-wing welfare.
Yeah.
Probably work through some, you know, think tank in D.C., and, you know, when they're ready to resurrect.
Yeah, oh, boy. You know, it's like, you're right, like a fungus will just keep coming back. Oh, well.
Yeah, but, you know, considering the pool of sharks Russert had to be around, decent guy, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I think he is just, he could be Tweety Bird, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think I said yesterday, I believe that he may have been embarrassed had he seen this whole thing that went on for days. I'm sure he would have. He was a decent guy.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for your call, Kevin. Good to hear from you.
Okay.
Bye now.
Bye.
866-546-5254 if you'd like to join us on the Guy James Show. He's kind of talking about leadership there a little earlier. Our candidates right now are so poll-driven. They really are. And poll-driven candidates, to me, they appear shallow. And that's what causes this flip-flopping. You're never going to convince me that these guys have changed their mind, like John McCain has flip-flopped so much
and other candidates as well. I don't know that I could be convinced that they've actually changed their mind about some seriously important issues the way they've talked about it anyway. I just think they've read the polls and thought, oh, I got to go with the other side. And we know they've done it. We know they have time and time and time again. Yeah. Yes, Glenn Beck, locally here, has replaced Laura Ingraham. And I don't know what's happened to the Laura Ingraham show. She says it's a contractual thing that she has to work out. Well, they've taken her off here locally and put on Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck, the fabulously intelligent Glenn Beck, the folks over at Media Matters put this out today. He estimated on his program that he inflated the estimated Anwar oil production by, well, it was close, only 7,000%. Glenn Beck told his legion of fools that watches his show that, quote, drilling in Anwar alone would yield 100 million barrels a day. That's right, he said that, 100 million barrels a day. Didn't say it once, said it several times. So the Energy Department of the United States, obviously not near as intelligent or well-versed on the oil situation in Anwar, the Energy Department of the United States said that if it's opened up for drilling for oil in 2008, the estimated peak production would yield, at most, 1.45 million barrels a day by the year 2028, 20 years from now. So, Glenn, 100 million, and the Energy Department saying only 1.45 million. You folks got to get together and talk about this just a little bit. Just a bit. According to the Energy Information Administration analysis, in 2008 of crude oil production in Anwar, it says in all three Anwar resource cases, Anwar crude oil production begins in 2018 and grows during most of the projection period before production begins to decline. In the mean oil resource case, Anwar oil production peaks at 780,000 barrels a day in 2027. The low resource case production peaks at 510,000 barrels a day in 2028. And so the, I don't know how they come up with this number. The cumulative anyway is going to be a maximum of 1.45 million barrels a day 20 years from now. 20 years. Beck is a real piece of work. He said, like I told you yesterday, gas is up 35%, electricity is up 30%. Natural gas, which most Americans use to heat their homes, will hit a record high next month, up 43% from last year. Oh boy, what happens when we hit November and December? Even with all that, domestic drilling is still stalled by Congress. It's like these people don't even live on the same planet, and this is really too bad, since drilling in Anwar alone would yield 100 million barrels a day. And you add that on to another 50 or 100 million barrels a day that the Chinese are drilling somewhere just south of Key West, according to the Republican reports that I've heard lately. Did you hear, talking about Fox News, I should have mentioned it back when I was talking about Fox News, on a special report, and again from Media Matters, Brit Hume stated that Malik Obama, Senator Obama's half-brother, tells the Jerusalem Post that if elected, his brother will be a good president for the Jewish people, despite his Muslim background. That's a quote from Brit Hume. In fact, the article to which Hume was apparently referring indicated that Malik Obama did not speak directly with the Post, but rather gave an interview to Israel's Army Radio. Moreover, nowhere in audio of the interview that ABC's Jake Tapper posted on Malik Obama did it assert that Obama will be a good president for the Jewish people despite his Muslim background. But on the June 16th edition of Fox News special report,
chief propagandist, host Britt Hume, pointed to a statement on Barack Obama's website that Obama has never been Muslim and is a committed Christian, and stated, "But Obama's half-brother is not so sure." Hume continued, "Malik Obama tells the Jerusalem Post that if elected, his brother will be a good president for the Jewish people, despite his Muslim background," says Britt Hume. It didn't say that, Britt. It didn't say that anywhere. There's Jake Tapper has the audio, and you see it's not there, Britt. So I think you owe Mr. Obama an apology. How many of you bet that they get that apology anytime soon? And I often rub it into my friends down in the state of Texas, the Lone Star State. And I ran across a story today that I couldn't help but read and start swearing after I read it. And you talk about racist. You talk about dirty, no-good racist without a conscience. You remember James Byrd Jr., Jasper, Texas. This is out of the Houston Chronicle. On the 10-year anniversary of the three racists in Jasper, Texas, dragging James Byrd Jr. behind their truck until his head snapped off, the Houston Chronicle featured the story and the family's work on getting some long overdue hate crimes legislation passed in Texas. When the family went to then Governor George W. Bush for help, he helped them to the door. And here's one of the responses over out of the Houston Chronicle about them mentioning that it was the 10-year anniversary of that horrible crime. This entitled Seeing Yellow over Jasper. This guy writes, his name is H.C. Alford, Houston, Texas. I wish I had his phone number and web address, because I'd give it. As a native of Jasper and longtime resident of Houston, I was outraged at the Chronicle's front page coverage of the events of June 7, 1998. Please see Jasper 10 years later. On June 7, 1998, James Byrd Jr.'s murder brought global attention to a small town where today some strive to preserve the memory and others wish the world could forget. The good people of Jasper have attempted to return their town to normalcy, only to be confronted with the media's relentless coverage of an event long since forgotten. Two perpetrators are on death row, and a third is in prison for life for the death of an African-American drug dealer. Let's stop right there. James Byrd Jr. was not a drug dealer. He was an African-American. He goes on to say, the days of William Randolph Hearst yellow journalism are long past, but the Houston Chronicle, as a Hearst publication, appears determined to bring these practices back to the 21st century. Signed, H.C. Alford, Houston, Texas. Well, well, well. He lives in Jasper, Texas, and close by, and he just doesn't want to be reminded of a hate crime that took place in Houston a little over 10 years ago, or in Jasper took place. Just doesn't want to be reminded of it. Folks are just trying to forget it. This is something that should never be forgotten. Not ever. I had another story about my favorite state of Texas, but I'm not going to have time to do it today. I think we'll talk about it. I was going to say tomorrow. We won't be here tomorrow. I've enjoyed being with you today. I do want to mention to you Thursday, this is the last day of the week for me here at the microphone. I do want to mention that we are having a fundraiser, and it's not going as well as we would like, as much as needed. And the show is listener-supported, you and I. Must support the show financially. We don't do advertising. We have no income like that, and so it is important at this time that if you can contribute to the show that you do so. And if it's at all possible, I know things are tough for a lot of people, and I understand.
And I just want you to know that we're not whistling Dixie here when we say things are difficult at the Guy James Show as far as keeping all the bills paid. So if you can help out with that, it is extremely important that you do so, because if we can't balance the budget, why, we'll have to turn off the electricity, if you know what I mean. So that's what I wanted to mention today, and I hope you can help us out on that. I really appreciate all the great email I get from you folks. I've got quite a few folks that send over email just about, well, every day or so, and I enjoy going through it. And I do want to apologize for not getting back to everybody on everything, because I just can't. Time keeps me from answering everything, but I do try. And you are the most educated and informed audience that a person could, a broadcaster like me could ever want. I highly respect my audience and their intellect and their, well, their just great knowledge of world events that goes on today. You never pull the wool over on people on the Head On Radio Network, that's for sure. I would put up our listeners head and shoulders above anybody else's as far as being informed. And why not? It's because we got all these good shows here. Hey, thanks for listening here on the Guy James Show today. It's always a pleasure. Thanks to Billy Shears, music director.